welcome to the Healthy Skeptic Podcast. My name is Danny Roddy, and with me is Chris Kresser, health detective and creator of thehealthyskeptic.org, a blog challenging mainstream myths about nutrition and health. Chris, we're on round two. How are you doing, buddy?
45 minutes of the best material ever.
That nobody will
ever
hear.
And it's gone. You'll never, ever hear it. You could just hear Danny's side of it, just nodding his head. And yeah, so hopefully my voice doesn't completely go out, since this is going to end up being a very long period of me just blabbing away.
We have a random grab bag episode, but before we start, how is your lady and how is the forthcoming child?
Oh, she's great, and baby is great. So, you know, I haven't had a chance to really, verify that, but it seems good. We're like I said, the first time around, we're doing a birth unplugged here. We haven't had an ultrasound, have not interacted with the medical establishment at all. We have a midwife, we're having a home birth. And so all we know is we're having a baby at some point in the next several weeks. Don't know who that baby is, you know, boy, girl, which is pretty cool. I think people miss out when they find out what it is in advance, because one of the things that's been really interesting is I've had no opportunity to project a whole identity onto this child. You know, like I'm not imagining playing catch, you know, all the things that I would do with a boy, or, you know, all the things I would do with a girl. It's just this kind of big mystery right now. And I'm enjoying it a lot because I feel like I'm really open to whoever is going to come out of there.
That's so cool. Yeah. So you haven't purchased the catcher's mitt yet?
No catcher's mitt, no blue nursery walls or pink nursery walls. And we have, you know, this hodgepodge of clothes that have mostly, I have six nieces and nephews. So, you know, my brothers and sisters-in-law have been setting us up as well as all of our friends. So we've got a little androgynous wardrobe going. And our baby will be a cross-dresser one way or the other.
Awesome. Cool, yeah. Man.
How's it going for you?
Good. Can't complain. Waiting for school to start. I purchased some new sweet Softstar Vibram five-finger like shoes, and I'm wearing them around town.
Hey, the paper bags on your feet.
Yeah, the running joke at my work is that I'm wearing static bags, which is always a good laugh.
Sweet. All right. So shall we dive into the grab bag-o-rama?
Grab bag super special, Chris.
Okay, sorry.
Okay, the first question is from my buddy who lives super close to here, Bill Mulan. Chris, what are your thoughts on thyroid glandulars? Can you comment on the quality, consistency, compared to Armour, West Thyroid, and Nature Thyroid, or Nature Thyroid? And then also he has a dual part question. Thoughts on raw milk versus colostrum. Is colostrum more or less tolerated? And what are your thoughts on colostrum for leaky gut?
Okay. I do use thyroid glandulars, but I tend to use them in more mild thyroid hypofunction cases where I don't, where it doesn't seem as important to control the consistency. Like you would have more control over with Armour or Westroid or Nature Thyroid. That is an issue. Armour is a very specific ratio of T4 to T3. It's 4.22 to 1, I think. I could be slightly off on that, but I think that's pretty close. Whereas the thyroid glandulars, you're just taking glandular extracts. So you're taking actual thyroid gland from usually a bovine source. So that can be helpful, but there's just less control over it in terms of the dosing. And something I've mentioned in my thyroid series on the blog on the Healthy Skeptic is that the key, and this is true for treating any condition, but certainly true with thyroid, is figuring out the nature of the problem, the exact nature of the disharmony or the problem, and addressing it at that level. And because if you don't, then the results are going to be limited. And a perfect example of that is I see a lot of mostly women, but sometimes men in my practice who have, you know, quote, hypothyroidism, and their doctors put them on levothyroxine because that's just what they do. You know, it's the popular one to use. And it's what a lot of doctors use. And in a lot of cases, these people have never even had their T3 tested. They've just had their TSH and their T4, their total T4. And when I run my labs and test their total T3, we see that their T4 is actually fairly normal. You know, that's been brought up from the levothyroxine, but their T3 is still in the toilet. And, you know, many people who listen to this will probably know that T4 is the inactive form of thyroid hormone, and it needs to be converted into T3, which is the active form, in order to have its physiologic effect on the tissues and the cells. So you could have, you know, fairly normal TSH, normal T4, but low T3, and you would still experience all of the signs and symptoms of hypothyroidism. And if you give that person T4, then the outcome is going to be not that great, because their problem is that they're over-converting T4 into reverse T3, or put another way, they're under-converting T4 into active T3. So this is really common. I would say like probably 70% of my thyroid patients have this T4 to T3 disconversion problem. And it's because inflammation causes it. And almost everyone who comes to see me has some level of inflammation. So again, it's important to address, to figure out what the mechanism is and then address that cause. And in most cases with Hashimoto's, which is the number one cause of thyroid disease, I think it's probably necessary for people to be on thyroid hormone replacement. If iodine deficiency is an issue, then that needs to be addressed as well. And sometimes just restoring, repleting iodine levels can be enough and make it so that thyroid hormone replacement isn't necessary. So the raw milk and colostrum question, truthfully, I haven't had a lot of success with colostrum, both personally and in my practice. I've tried it on and off for years with patients, and I've tried it myself several times, and I just haven't seen much benefit from it. I know the theories about why it should work, and I know that it's crucial and important for newborns. And that's one of the reasons why breastfeeding right after birth is so important, because it's mostly colostrum that they're getting. But I just haven't really seen a lot of benefit.
Agreed. I've tried raw milk and colostrum both, and I never could tell a difference between either one.
Mm-hmm. I mean, raw milk, of course, there's a whole other issues about, you know, what people might react to in raw milk. And we've talked about that a lot, so we won't beat a dead horse. We can move on to the next one, especially since we just talked about it about 20 minutes ago.
So. Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, the listeners are really getting the short end of the stick on this one.
Yeah.
Okay, this one is from Brandon Freese. What do you recommend for low hormone levels of thyroid and testosterone? What are your thoughts on HRT? And he's talking about hormone replacement therapy.
Right. Okay. I went into a whole long thing about menopause, which was so fun. And we'll have to do it again. We'll do a whole show on it, I promise, because it's a big issue. And, you know, although no man likes to admit that they are in menopause, because it's not very manly, it's pretty common phenomena, I think, and it's happening prematurely more and more, and it's a big issue. So I definitely want to talk about it at some point, but I'll just do, I'll answer the question more directly here. There are many, we just talked about thyroid, and it's kind of impossible to say what should you do for low levels of thyroid hormone, because the answer to that question depends on why thyroid hormone levels are low. Are they low because T4 is not being converted into T3? Are they low because the person has Hashimoto's and there's this uncontrolled autoimmune destruction of the thyroid gland? Are they low because a person's iodine deficient? Are they low because the person has inflammation and that is The inflammatory cytokines are depressing pituitary function, and then the pituitary can't secrete enough TSH to stimulate T4 and T3 production. You get in the picture, right?
It's endless.
So I can't answer a question of what to do with low thyroid hormones because it completely depends on why thyroid hormone is low. And I've covered that on the blog in detail. If you haven't seen it, go to healthyskeptic.org/thyroid. There's probably like 12 articles on it in a lot of detail. So check that out if you haven't. Testosterone, I haven't talked about much. And as I said, I'm planning to do a series on it, maybe sometime after I get out of the intensive diaper changing phase. So it probably won't be in the near future, but it's important. It's an important thing for men's health because men should be naturally androgen dominant, just like women should be naturally estrogen dominant. And for a male, testosterone has a protective effect. It protects against cardiovascular disease, cancer, diabetes. Really, all of the top 10 causes of death for men are, you can argue that low testosterone plays a role in each of them. So for example, Alzheimer's, I think, is the number 10 cause of death now for men, and it's growing every year. And low testosterone has been linked with Alzheimer's and cognitive decline and memory loss. It's also been linked with depression and anxiety. I think suicide and depression is number 7 on the list of top 10 causes of death for men. And that's probably via inflammation, which we're going to talk a little bit more about in a second, because low testosterone has been, is associated with increased LH levels, luteinizing hormone. And luteinizing hormone has been shown to promote degeneration of the hippocampus, which is the part of the brain that degenerates in Alzheimer's and dementia. So getting back to the importance of addressing the underlying cause, just like I can't say, what do you do for low thyroid hormone? I can't say, what do you do for low testosterone without knowing what the causes are. And there are some basic patterns for menopause that we'll talk about when we do an episode on this in the future. But in general, I can kind of break it down into two things. The main causes of low testosterone and increased estrogen levels are insulin resistance and inflammation. Once again, inflammation rears its ugly head. I mean, show me a disease and I'll show you inflammation. So just to give you a kind of idea on how this works, and it, like most processes in the body, it's cyclical, and it's a chicken and egg downward spiral type of thing where you get elevation of inflammatory cytokines and insulin resistance. Both promote each other. So inflammation promotes insulin resistance, and insulin resistance promotes inflammation. Both of those both cause and are caused by leaky gut, systemic inflammation in the body, which both cause and are caused by obesity and neurodegeneration, which both are caused and caused by vascular degeneration, like cardiovascular disease. And if you draw this out in a schematic with all of those factors that I just mentioned, you see just a bunch of arrows, with double ends pointing to each other. So it just becomes like a tangle of causality and everything just promoting everything. It's ugly, when you see it actually diagrammed out. And so that's the vicious cycle that people that we can get into, and that becomes a downward spiral, because as inflammatory cytokine surges happen and insulin resistance happens, then that increases body fat. And then as body fat increases, that causes more inflammation and more insulin resistance. And all of that together upregulates an enzyme called aromatase, which converts testosterone into estrogen. And that's when you get things like man boobs. And, the accumulation of fat around the middle is that when you see someone who's got that going, that is usually excess estrogen and probably also excess cortisol. But this aromatization is kind of the core of the problem in a lot of cases. And you don't want that as a man. I mean, in addition to the undesirable appearance of man boobs, that's a sign that you are not androgen dominant, or you have too much estradiol, and of course that can predispose you to, you know, heart disease and strokes and Alzheimer's and diabetes and all kinds of other fun stuff. So now let's get to the second part of the question, which I think was, what do you think about hormone replacement therapy, right?
Exactly.
Okay, so in order to fully explain what I think about this, I need to give you some basic physiology in terms of how hormone regulation works in the body. It works on a negative feedback system, and the pituitary gland sits up in the brain, and you can think of it as like the control tower for hormones. And it monitors levels of hormones in the bloodstream. And when hormone levels are low, the pituitary will send a message to the particular gland that produces that hormone to increase production. And that message is in the form of stimulating hormones. So you have thyroid stimulating hormone, you have follicle stimulating hormone, or FSH, you have luteinizing hormone, which is LH. And those are the relevant ones in testosterone production. It's luteinizing hormone that acts on the Leydig cells in the testes. Okay, so the way this would work is, if testosterone levels are low, the pituitary notices that, and it will produce more luteinizing hormone, so that luteinizing hormone will stimulate the Leydig cells to produce more testosterone. Does that make sense?
Uh-huh.
Okay, so likewise, if testosterone levels are high, then you would expect the pituitary to produce less LH, so that, you know, less stimulation of the Leydig cells happens and less testosterone gets produced. So that's the negative feedback system. And it's amazingly complex. I mean, we know a lot about it. We've learned a lot, but there are still aspects of it that we don't fully understand. For example, all of the hormones that are produced in the body are produced bound to a protein. This is because hormones are fat soluble and they can't be transported through the bloodstream unless they're bound to a protein. So in the case of thyroid hormone, it's secreted attached to thyroid binding globulin, which is the protein. And in the case of sex hormones like testosterone, they're secreted attached to sex hormone binding globulin. And in order for those protein-bound hormones are inactive, so they can't have any effect on the tissues or cells. And in order for them to have an effect, they have to be cleaved from that protein carrier. And we don't understand how the body knows when to do that, or how exactly that happens. So there's a lot that we don't understand about the body. And as much as we like to think we do, there's a lot that we don't. And so here's how this all comes into play with hormone replacement therapy. So let's say somebody has low testosterone because they have low levels of luteinizing hormone, which is, you know, what, as I just said, what stimulates testosterone production. And the reason they have low levels of luteinizing hormone might be because they've got inflammation that is suppressing pituitary function. What happens if that person takes testosterone? Well, a few things are going to happen. Number one, it's not going to address the underlying cause of low testosterone, which in this case is inflammation. It's just like putting a Band-Aid over the problem. It doesn't address the underlying cause. The second thing that's going to happen is that it's going to completely bypass the body's natural regulatory feedback mechanism, which I just described. And that's not good, because we don't know how to operate that system like the body knows how to do it. And, you know, so when you take testosterone, what's going to happen is the pituitary gland's going to go, oh, great, we've got plenty of testosterone. And it's going to reduce further the production of LH. And of course, that's going to mean that even less internal testosterone will be produced, which means the person taking testosterone will have to increase their dose. And guess what happens when they increase their dose? It further suppresses LH, which further reduces the amount of testosterone that the body produces. Now, I mean, it's kind of funny when we think about it and talk about it, but it's also kind of sad, because I see a lot of patients in my practice, both women and men, who've been on supplemental hormones for a long time. And the ones that are especially a problem are the creams, because the cream is usually in their hormones in the free fraction state. So they are absorbed directly through the skin into the bloodstream in the free state. So they're available immediately to act on the tissues. And the difference there, if you take usually oral hormones are in their protein bound state. And so the body still has some control. It can still, as I described, it can still decide when it cleaves those protein bound hormones and makes them free and available to the tissues. But that's not true with hormone creams. So I've seen men with, you know, who've been on testosterone creams and, you know, they get on the cream and they feel fantastic for the first week. You know, they're just like, oh, I'm a new person. I can run personal records in the gym. I'm getting the chicks, and you know, they're like way into it. Right. But then a couple weeks later, you know, they start feeling bad again. Their libido's decreased. They're not, you know, plateaued at the gym. You know, they just feel terrible. And so what happens? They increase their dose and then they feel good again. They're back on the ball. You know, everything's working. And then usually in about less time, this time around, they feel bad. And then they increase the dose again. And then, you know, some point they've really screwed up their system, because what happens is the body, in its wisdom, in spite of our often stupidity, and that's not directed at anyone that's taking hormone replacement. It's just a sort of general comment about human monkey mindness, I guess I would call it, where we're always trying to mess around with things that we don't understand and getting ourselves in trouble in the process. So what happens is the body is smart, and the body will do everything it can to protect itself against this excess testosterone exposure. And one of the ways that it does that is by A, down-regulating receptor site sensitivity, so that the receptors for thyroid hormone on the cells will become less sensitive to testosterone, just like in insulin resistance. And number two, the body will actually down-regulate the number of receptor sites on the cell for testosterone. And that's its smart, intelligent way of protecting itself from too much free testosterone hanging around in the blood. So it's doing everything it can to stay well in spite of us, you know, while we're taking the excess hormone. And over time, that just becomes more and more pronounced. And so the big problem is that when we stop the hormone, we're kind of in a bad way, because not only is, let's say, just use testosterone as the example here, not only is LH completely suppressed because of the external supplementation, which means that there will be very little internal production of testosterone, the cells have not only few receptors, but the receptors they do are insensitive to testosterone. So you take somebody off testosterone hormone that's been on it for a long time like that, it's literally like pulling the rug out from under them. And there's going to be a period of weeks where they are very unhappy because it's going to take a while for the receptor site function to upregulate and for the cells to express more receptors and for the LH production to increase. And that's assuming that the underlying cause is being addressed, which would, you know, often would be inflammation and or insulin resistance.
Been there, done that.
Right. So this is where you see like the bodybuilder folks. I know you used to hang out in some of those forums where they just dig themselves deep into the hole. And like it gets worse and worse.
The deepest holes. It was like never ending. I was going to say, do you know who you can write a letter to thank for all this transdermal hormone usage, Chris? So
about 500 practitioners on the web that have an entire practice based on hormone replacement creams. But who are you thinking about?
Suzanne Summers.
Oh, right. That's right. The sugar blues and the hormone replacement. She got one part of that right.
Awesome. I could not agree anymore with what you just said.
I feel bad now. I feel like I might have been a little harsh on people taking hormone creams. It's actually more directed at people who are prescribing the hormone creams. And even then, I think most people just are doing their best and have, you know, are trying to help other people, and that's what they believe will help. I'm just kind of frustrated at the lack of education around this issue and why more people don't understand this this phenomenon that I just described. Because if you understand the physiology, it's perfectly clear how that would be a bad idea. But I guess the other thing is it's a lot easier to take a hormone, to prescribe and take a hormone cream, than it is to often to make the necessary diet and lifestyle changes that would be required to address the underlying mechanisms.
Chris, real quickly, I know menopause, what age range do you think that is? Is there any different protocol for a younger gentleman?
I think menopause is menopause, but you can enter into it prematurely any time if you start getting really inflamed and insulin resistant. So I don't really necessarily treat them differently, other than that there may be cause or effects like neurodegeneration that are more common later on in life, simply because there's been more of a chance for that to happen. You know, it's fairly rare to see severe neurodegeneration that, you know, for a 21-year-old male, but it can happen if there's enough inflammation and gut problems and blood sugar irregularities.
In a world of Four Loko, I could see neurodegeneration happen
quite
rapidly.
Some people might argue there's a lot of neurodegenerated young men out there, but that's maybe a different cause, a different story.
All right, cool. This next question is completely different question. This is from Cara D. Leon. I don't know how to say that. My question is regarding magnesium and potassium. For those who suffer with constipation, how much of both of these supplements should one take to help the situation? I already eat paleo, and I'm currently pulling nightshades and eggs out of my diet. Mm-hmm. What do you think, Chris?
It depends. No, it's a good question. And of course, the answer is not the same for everybody. It depends. I mean, I test people's magnesium levels. And even though that's not a super accurate test, if someone comes back below 2.0, they're, in 99% of cases, they're going to really benefit from magnesium supplementation. So
do you just do serum magnesium?
I do serum. There, you know, red blood cell magnesium is more accurate. And then there's one lab in the country that does intracellular magnesium, which and claims that that's even more accurate than red blood cell magnesium. But you know, those tests are pretty expensive. They're more expensive, and I've just found magnesium is one of the nutrients that I think many people should be supplementing with, because it's hard to find in a healthy diet. It's, you know, nuts are the biggest source, and dark chocolate I think is a pretty good source, but nuts and chocolate have phytates, and they also have, in the case of nuts, significant amounts of omega-6. So I don't necessarily like to see people gobbling down huge amounts of nuts to get their magnesium. And I definitely wouldn't want to see someone gobbling huge, huge amounts of chocolate for that reason either. Although they might enjoy that. Typically, if somebody's magnesium deficient, I'll put them on 600 to 800 milligrams of magnesium glycinate. And now the form is important. Most supplements have magnesium citrate or magnesium oxide, and those are not really well absorbed. So they have some effect for constipation, but they tend to bring a lot of water into the bowel and cause kind of loose stools, or what I sometimes call consteria, which I'm sure you can figure out for yourself what that is. But magnesium, the chelated forms of magnesium and magnesium glycinate and malate tend to be much better absorbed. And so I think I have a lot more success with them. So I would say, you know, 600 to 800 milligrams of magnesium glycinate. Potassium, I don't use as much for constipation. There is a product called Ageless Hydro C, which I sometimes give to my patients. It's got a blend of a highly absorbable form of vitamin C, calcium, magnesium, and potassium. But the amount of potassium is pretty small. It's 40 milligrams, which is like 1% of the RDA. And then the vitamin C is, it can also have an effect on bowel regularity. So you could take a gram or 2 grams or up to 3 grams of vitamin C per day, up, you know, really up to bowel tolerance. But if you take too much vitamin C, that will also create often, you know, diarrhea or loose stool. So you got to be careful there.
Do you think the constipation is a result of a magnesium deficiency, or is this another thing that you kind of have to do some investigative work on and like finding the actual root cause of constipation?
Ding, 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 ding. Yeah. Well, certainly magnesium deficiency can cause constipation, but and magnesium can help even if there's another cause. But you're right. It definitely have to look and see what the underlying cause is. And in my experience, constipation is 99% of the time due to gut dysbiosis, because something like 70 to 80% of the dry weight of stool is dead bacteria. And so if you don't have, you're not producing a lot of good, healthy gut flora, you're going to have problems forming bulky stool, and you're going to have problems with intestinal motility. So the long-term solution to constipation is almost always addressing the gut flora, but magnesium can be really helpful in the short term, especially if there's a deficiency.
Awesome. Cool. Okay, bear with me. This one's kind of long. This one's from Robbie Garfinkel. I've been doing paleo, high fat, moderate protein. Carbs range from 20 to 50 grams per day of citrus, buckwheat, yams, and green veggies since January. So far, I went from 164 to 152 pounds. Awesome, Robbie.
Nice work.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm a male, 41 years old, and my hair seems to be thinning since I was 19. But so far, I'm not completely bald. About 3 months into paleo, I noticed some thinning and dismissed it. But now it's definitely obvious. My hair seems to thin quite rapidly, even after only a few weeks. I will soon be completely bald up top if this keeps up. Is this a coincidence or something to do with my diet and current state of health? More information. I've had borderline high blood pressure for a few years. Recently, this has gone from the 140s to 160s. My libido has suddenly gone downhill as well. I know the liver is involved in a lot. I was a moderate, heavy social drinker for about 10 years. I've cut down drastically when I started paleo. He says his liver enzymes show up just fine. He also says that stress is fairly high, and he's worried about money, job, and he has sleep apnea as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. One of the first thoughts I have is he's on a very low carb diet. 20 to 50 grams is extremely low, in my opinion. And I know that can be helpful for weight loss and for some people. Certainly seems like it's worked for Robbie. However, there is some, at least anecdotal evidence. I don't know about actual studies that show this, but that low carb diets, I certainly see it in my practice. I know other practitioners have reported it. Chris Masterjohn talks about it. That low carb diets can have an adverse effect on thyroid function. And one of the primary symptoms of hypothyroidism or low thyroid function is hair loss. So that's one thought, that this low carb diet is adversely affecting Robbie's thyroid function, and that is causing some of the hair loss and could even be contributing to the low libido as well. And another thought is that there's, you know, some kind of inflammatory process going on that could be stress related and cortisol related. Like cortisol dysregulation from this, you know, all of the stress that he's been through recently. And that is, causing some kind of inflammation that in turn is promoting hair loss. But Danny, you are the hair loss expert, so I would love to hear your opinion on this question.
Hardly. I'm going to align right with you. I think his very low carbing, that might be a major stressor. Mm-hmm. So the thing that comes to mind is telogen effluvium, which is like the medical name for rapid hair loss if you're in a state of malnutrition or you're dieting really badly. He doesn't say that he's restricting calories, but I wouldn't be surprised if he was.
Yeah, that tends to happen spontaneously on a diet that, you know, that low in carbs.
Exactly, because yeah. Male pattern baldness isn't a rapid thing that happens all in a couple months. It happens over a long period of time. So anytime it's happening very fast, it's probably a major stressor, like you said. Mm-hmm. And the only other thing I would throw in that I'm glad he mentioned was he had high blood pressure. So, Chris, I'm going to need your help on this, but I know aldosterone is part of the renin-angiotensin system, mm-hmm. and aldosterone is, in all my research, correlated with premature hair loss. So if he was willing to go to the doctor, and you can help me on this again, do you ever, or is there a test to measure aldosterone?
Well, the question still would be what's causing both of those, you know, what's causing the elevation in the aldosterone and the elevated blood pressure. But if it's always been high, or no, he said, what did you say, for a few years?
I had borderline high blood pressure for a few years.
Yeah, I'm thinking that stress is probably the major player here in addition to the low carb diet, because the stress can raise the blood pressure. It can cause inflammation. It can promote the hair loss. And the cortisol dysregulation is also associated with sleep apnea. So
totally. That's exactly where I was going. I was just going to throw in, I have an article on my site, and I remember digging up some research on PubMed suggesting that aldosterone can be reduced, oddly enough, with salt. So mm-hmm. I know that a salt restrictive diet can increase synthesis of aldosterone.
Yeah, which a lot of paleo people are doing, either intentionally or unintentionally. I mean, the original version of the paleo diet suggested salt restriction, right?
Exactly. And then another thing to look into, that a vitamin D deficiency can also increase the renin-angiotensin system, increasing aldosterone. But like you said, he'd have to find the root cause of the stress, which mm-hmm. can be so many things. It will make your head spin.
Yeah. And to manage it, which, you know, we talked about this before, but I didn't say eliminate, because most of us can't do that. But there are a lot of things we can do to manage stress and to mitigate the impact that it has on us. And, you know, I've written about some of those things in the 9 Steps Perfect Health series on my blog. I can't remember what step it was, maybe 7 or 8 or something, but go check that out. And there's some recommendations there for how you can improve your stress tolerance. That's probably the best way of saying it.
Awesome. Cool. Okay. Our next question is from Barbara. She hails from Boston. I am hypothyroid on Armour and a small dose of Synthroid with pretty good results. I took Iodorol. And am I saying that right?
Iodorol
for a few months and initially felt fabulous. Good energy, better aerobic capacity when cycling, and all over good effects. I did not make my TSH level go up nor make me hyperthyroid. However, it did give me a runny nose to the point of causing a weeping rash at the bottom of my nose. Does it seem that I am allergic? I took it for a few months and started it again at a very small dose, but the same thing happened. Any ideas?
Yes, I do have an idea, actually. Some people with iodine deficiency, which it sounds like she has based on her response to it, also have bromide toxicity. Now, bromide is a halide which is capable of binding the iodine receptor and blocking uptake of iodine. And, you know, it's found naturally in seaweed and seafood, in salt water. In low to moderate amounts, I suppose you could induce bromide toxicity. I think I've seen some studies of Japanese coastal people who have bromide toxicity from eating tons and tons of seaweed and seafood. But the main, you know, exposure to it in our part of the world is that it's used in a lot of plastic products, including computers. And it's also a flame retardant that's found in carpet and clothing, mattresses, and a lot of other consumer goods. Also, bromide is now added to baked goods. I'm assuming that Barbara is probably maybe not eating a lot of baked goods, but if she did at some point in her life, that could be part of the exposure. It used to be that iodine was added to baked goods, but now they use bromide. And guess what? One of the main sources, effects of bromide toxicity is, it's actually called bromoderma. This just kind of sounds like bro, I'm a derma man, bro. which is like an acne-like papular raised eruption of the face and hands, but it can also cause the more a macular non-raised rash, particularly on the face. So my guess is that this is, and what happens, you know, the way that you detox bromide is by taking iodine. So iodine will help clear excess bromide from the body. And so what I suspect is happening is she takes iodine and that starts detoxing the bromide. And then she gets this rash. So my suggestion would be to take less iodine and go really slowly and just try to see if you can manage it in such a way that you don't get the rash, or if you get it, it's mild and you can work through it. With iodine, you really need to move slowly when you're taking it. I think probably starting off at a small dose under, you know, like a milligram or even less, maybe for people who are sensitive, and doubling it every 10 days to 2 weeks. So it could take, you know, months to build up to a higher dose, like 12.5 milligrams or more, which is some people recommend more. And then make sure you're taking enough selenium when you're taking iodine, because particularly if you have Hashimoto's, if you take iodine alone and you're selenium deficient, that can trigger or flare an autoimmune response. And I have learned a lot recently in the last 6 months from my patients, also from looking at the scientific literature, and then a guy called Mario who used to comment, left some comments on my blog a while back when I wrote the thyroid series, and just wrote a 2-article series on the perfect health diet about using iodine in people with Hashimoto's. And what the literature seems to suggest, and some of my patients' experience, is that iodine only causes problems in Hashimoto's in the presence of selenium deficiency, which is quite common, unfortunately. And so that's why you see a lot of reactions to iodine with people with Hashimoto's. But if it appears that if you take enough selenium, or if you're selenium sufficient, then iodine can actually benefit people with Hashimoto's, especially those that have concurrent iodine deficiency. So that's what I'd recommend for Barbara. I mean, I'm not sure that that's what's happening, but it seems the most likely scenario.
Yeah. Is there any given time for how long it would take one to detox from bromide? Is there any literature on that?
I don't think there's any literature, but, you know, there are guys like Dr. Brownstein and Dr. Abraham who've been treating patients with iodine for a really long time. And from what I've read of their materials, in some cases it can take 6 months or over a year, even in the more severe cases. So it's unfortunately something you really just have to be patient with and go slowly with. Just kind of listen to your body and see what kind of response you're having, and not... Yeah, it just requires a lot of patience.
Just keeping your nose clean.
Yep.
Okay, let's go to Blake Smith's question. I have a question about protein shakes. I supplement them for the protein and the calories, specifically BSN Syntha 6, Muscle Milk Cookies and Cream, Optimum Nutrition, casein protein. These are all the same ones that you take, Chris, which is crazy. Are there any of them on the market that you'd recommend, or would you suggest making your own? Have any recipes? I'm at the gym 3 to 4 times a week, weightlifting to build muscle. He's not a huge runner. Regular diet is pretty clean. I'm not sure what that means, but besides the occasional indulgence in ice cream and restaurants. What do you think, Chris?
And these protein shakes bars, he says. Right. So I'm not a fan of protein shakes or bars, as most of you probably know by now. They're extremely processed in most cases. They are, you know, contain a lot of isolated synthetic nutrients. I generally don't think people need to be on a high protein diet. I mean, even our need for protein, like 15% of calories is generally enough. It doesn't sound like he's doing tons of bodybuilding, but even if he was, you could bump that up to 20 or 20, 20, even 25%, which is pretty high in my opinion. And I think that would provide all of the protein that's necessary for building muscle without any powders. The powders are, like I said, they're highly processed, and I don't see a need for them in the context of a healthy paleo plus raw dairy, or, you know, whatever you want to call it, real food kind of diet. Fat is a really, you know, it's the structural part of all cells. It's the preferred storage form of energy for the body. And I think a higher fat, moderate protein, moderate carbohydrate diet is a better choice. And I don't really see any need for protein powders.
If he wanted to get jacked, would you be opposed to the old school methods of like raw eggs and raw milk or something like that?
We're
not really bodybuilders, but
no. So I'm probably not the best person to ask for it, but yeah, I mean, the Rocky Balboa, so crack a few raw eggs, but he did it wrong though, because you can't eat raw egg whites. Well, you can, but it's not a good idea because they contain trypsin inhibitors. They contain avidin, which inhibits the digestion of trypsin. And if you cook egg whites, that avidin gets at least partially destroyed, but not so in the raw egg whites. But you can eat raw egg yolks, and if you get them from pasture-raised chickens, and the yolks contain most of the protein and nutrients anyways, or most of the good nutrients. So certainly raw egg yolks and raw milk, or if you don't tolerate raw milk, like kefir, for example, like make a shake with kefir and several raw egg yolks and some coconut oil and, you know, melted coconut oil. And that's like the best sort of shake you could have, you know, and gnaw on some liver while you're at it, and that's the real superfood shake.
Exactly.
If you can take it,
he can replace his Synthesix with raw liver.
Probably won't taste as good as Muscle Milk cookies and cream, though. I'm guessing with the liver in it, it would without the liver. Yeah. So, anyways, I'm not a fan of the powders. They seem overly processed, and I don't think they're necessary. But I'm not a bodybuilder, so there's a caveat.
That's going to bring us to the end of this week's episode. You can find all of Chris's work at thehealthyskeptic.org. You can find me at dannyroddy.com. Keep sending us your questions at thehealthyskeptic.org using the podcast submission link. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, head over to iTunes and leave us a review. Thank you for listening, and thank you for your support.